Good afternoon. I'd like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, May 3rd. Let the record reflect. It is 1:34 p.m. Today we have present Representative Groh, Representative Carpenter, Representative Eastman, Representative Gray, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind the committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Sophia Tenney with House Records and Talia Ames from the Juneau LIO. Thank you for your work. We've also been joined by Representative Johnson. On today's agenda, the committee will bring back House Bill 29, Insurance Discrimination, by Representative McCabe in its second hearing. And then we will bring back House Bill 129, Voter Registration, in its second hearing. So I'd like to now open up public testimony on House Bill 29. Is there anyone in the room who would like to give public testimony on House Bill 29? Seeing none, and I don't see anyone online for public testimony, so I will now close public testimony. So I would like to invite Representative McCabe and his staff to the table. If you could just give us a quick recap of the bill before we consider amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Kevin McCabe from House District 30, and with me is my staff buddy Witt, Mr. Buddy Witt. And as far as a quick recap, as we said last time, insurance companies are actually in the business of discrimination, but only within certain parameters. And what we are asking with this bill is that the insurance company not discriminate on the front end because of employment as an elected official. So we are asking that they prohibit, and actually we're asking, this bill asks that they prohibit discrimination, a state prohibits discrimination solely on the basis of being an elected official. We know, and as we said last time, that the insurance companies can discriminate against you if you've had a great number of car accidents and that sort of thing. But when they do it up front and say, you're a legislator, I can't issue you a policy, we think that that is improper. So that's a quick recap, and I'm happy to answer any more questions.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. And my apologies to those watching online. If you did not have an opportunity to testify on House Bill 29, you can submit your written testimony to house.judiciary@akleg.gov. We have received three amendments for House Bill 29, and we will start with Amendment Number 1 by Representative
Johnson. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Amendment Number 1. Thank you, Madam Chair. Amendment Number 1 is a title change. I think an act relating to insurance discrimination leaves the title open for any type of discrimination to be added to this bill. I don't believe it's the sponsor's intent to have that happen. And so I've changed that, or proposing to change, deleting insurance discrimination to prohibiting certain insurance decisions based solely on a person's political party or a person's status as an elected official. And then on page 1, line 4, delete discrimination and insert decisions. This is strictly a tightening the title up amendment.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Any discussion on Amendment Number 1? Representative Eastman, do you maintain your objection?
I withdraw my objection.
Hearing no further objections, Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We have Amendment Number 2 by Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I move Amendment 2.
Object for the purpose of discussion.
There has been an objection. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. The reference to political parties was interesting. And following the reference to membership in a political party, this amendment would also add discrimination, now called decisions, but same effect, based on a person's political view. And if it's the fits the committee as well, that we not be discriminating against people based on their political party, then I think it's a natural extension that we not be discriminating on someone based on political view, which is held by a political party.
Any discussion on number two? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just asked the sponsor for their input, if I could.
Thank you, Madam through the chair, Representative Johnson. We're sort of neutral on this amendment. We don't view it as harmful to the objective of the bill. I don't really think that it's necessary. It was actually the party that's in there now was suggested in an amendment in another committee. And the same thing, I think initially it said political expression or political affiliation. And we accepted that amendment, so I don't know why we would be upset with this one. It just kind of adds a little to it, but I don't have an opinion one way or the other on what it does for.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I read the amendment, when I first read it through political view, I know what those words mean, but the definition that follows on line 6 and 7 of the amendment means a position that a state or national political party takes in support of or in opposition to an issue. I immediately thought of an actual position, like a member of a board or some sort of position, not a philosophical point. And so I question whether that might be confusing to some as they read it. Is it meaning that if there's a national political party receives a position of some sort, or is it a candidate's position or a policy statement, I think is what we're trying to get at, right? I don't know that I have a question, just that it kind of concerns me that I misread it or misinterpreted it, I think, right off the bat.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I think my question here is just how broad this would be in terms of if someone's a member of like an anarchist party or believes in overthrowing the government or doesn't believe that the state government or the United States government is legitimate. The reason why I bring that up is I could see how that sort of political position might invite lawsuits. So again, it kind of gets back to something that we talked about earlier on Monday about if somebody's position puts them in a place where they're being sued multiple times, I would hope that this amendment and the bill underneath it wouldn't prevent an insurance company from saying we can't pay your legal fees over and over and over again, if that makes sense. So it might be going beyond the amendment, but I just wanted to touch on the fact that I would be worried about forcing an insurance company to pay legal fees for somebody whose political view or position might leave them very vulnerable to multiple lawsuits.
I have a question for Representative Eastman as well, and then we'll allow you to answer all the questions. The question that I have is how is this defensible? A person's political view is ambiguous, whereas the underlying bill has a particular party that is easily defined and proven, as well as an elected status. And those are very concrete things. And was wondering what your thoughts were on how this could be defensible and proven.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. On the question of position, the position being referred here is a political position, not a political job or appointment or nomination. And so I think that the drafters reflecting the intent of the request is just we're talking about views. And that's why it's, you know, the actual wording above is a person's political view. And if we want to invite insurance companies to make decisions based on an individual's, you know, personal political view, that would be one thing. I don't think we want to do that. And so this is going to limit a company from being able to do that. To the other question, you know, there's, I suppose there are some things that might be considered political views, which are illegal. Maybe anarchism falls into that category. An illegal act is not protected merely because someone calls it a political view. That is a criminal act, and of course, someone can discriminate based on the fact that someone has committed a political act, has received a conviction, and so forth. So there's no intent, and I don't think there would be any application to protect some kind of illegal behavior by simply reflecting what I think is already fairly bedrock, you know, First Amendment behavior. You know, if a person has a personal political view, that's not, you know, the sort of thing that you can discriminate against that person for having. Now, on the, you know, how do you prove it? Well, just like with proving whether or not someone's being discriminated against because of their political party or because, you know, they're an elected official, the mechanism for proof is something we can discuss a little bit in Amendment Number 3, but we're not changing the way that that would work. You know, if you have a complaint, you're saying my insurance company is discriminating against me because I'm a Republican or because I'm a member of the Green Party or any other party for that matter, then my read on the bill is you can, you know, file that complaint and you could, in effect, you know, have a case for a potential lawsuit if you believe someone's, you know, wronged you and broken the law in doing so, just like any other lawsuit. But I don't see that this would be noticeably different than trying to prove that, you know, you're being discriminated against because you're a Democrat. You know, it would be the same. If you have evidence, then you can show that would demonstrate that you've been discriminated against because your political party or because, you know, a view you have that coincides with your political party. Those would be treated, you know, fairly similarly, I would think.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative McCabe, for the record. So keep in mind here that when we said, when we brought this bill forward, it was as an elected official. So you are elected, in our case, by 18,335 people. You have some form of responsibility and somebody that you are accountable to. If you are a member of a party, which is why I didn't object to the last, to the changing it from political view or affiliation to party, you also have a number of people and a procedure for applying to the party. If you're elected to the school board, you are elected by people. Political view, I think, having heard now Representative Eastman describe what his amendment is, the political view, I could change my political view tomorrow. Or if the insurer denied me, I can say, well, you denied me because I view that Chevelle Supersports are the best car on the planet, or something like that. And I just don't know now that we haven't broadened the bill with this language, or we wouldn't broaden the bill with this language to the point where it would be meaningless.
Thank and you.
If you don't mind,
Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only other question that was discussed when we were presented with this amendment is how would insurance companies look at this? And then how would they be able to manage this if this bill were to pass now, this statutory directive on discrimination? And I was going to suggest the chair, since she is here, Director Wingheim might be able to give some insight into that on how insurance companies would look at this additional provision. Just thought I'd throw it out there.
Ms. Wehar, are you available to come and speak to Amendment Number 2?
For the record, my name is Lori Wing-Hire. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Madam Chair, I tend to agree with Representative McCabe. This is getting kind of broad, and I think political view would cause insurers some concern because of the fact that you could change your political view day to day. You may take a stand on a bill and then Representative Carpenter talks to you and you take a different stand. And to me, that would be your political view. I also know there was a comment made about legal fees, and I just want to Representative Gray a minute. So if you have repeated claims, you don't need to worry about them paying legal fees over and over again because they will cancel you. I mean, you get so many claims that at some point they would cancel you, sir. But this, I don't know if this adds anything that we can quantify in underwriting.
Is it your view, Ms. Wingheyer, that this would be fall under more of a freedom of speech issue versus discrimination?
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. Through the chair, a question to the amendment or the sponsor of the amendment. Does political view and political position, could they also be described as political expression? Meaning it's not just what I believe, but it's what I'm demonstrating, either by word or holding a sign or something like that. It's an expression of some sort, more than just an opinion. Is that what you're getting at with regards to the amendment?
No, actually, it's not focused on how something is expressed. It is simply the idea that we're going to discriminate against someone because they hold a particular viewpoint. And so that sort of sets aside whether or not they're good at expressing that viewpoint. You know, if they do it in a criminal or illegal way, and that's a different matter. And certainly insurance companies can take that into account. It is strictly limited to the fact that you believe some particular something about a political issue on which a political party has taken an issue. So how much you love a certain sports car would not probably be on that list because a political party hasn't adopted, you know, whether or not they like that car as well. But if you have a particular opinion on the Second Amendment, for example, that would be a position on which at least one or more political parties have a position. So your ability to hold that is not something that we want insurance companies to be able to say, well, you know, those people that like or don't like the Second Amendment, you know, I don't think we really want them as customers.
Follow up, Representative Carpenter.
So thank you for that answer. I'm not sure how we would empower any organization to understand what I'm thinking, nor would we want to. I think the only way that an insurance company would know what my view is if I express it, either in written word or by my affiliation or something like that. And I would just point to the bill, line 6, that the language speaks because of a person's political affiliation or expression or a person's status as an elected state official. So I would think that the expression piece of this, the person's expression, political expression, would capture anything regarding a person's view other than their thoughts in their head that haven't been expressed to somebody, which is not knowable, and we shouldn't be engaging in that realm of thinking anyway.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, my mind is just mulling over these concepts. And, you know, being a member of a political party, you could also change that on the spur of the moment as well. We have folks who, in Alaska, we have a lot of non-affiliated people. And I don't know how that would work with the original bill. You know, if you applied as a Democrat and they denied that umbrella coverage, but then you went and changed your affiliation to non-affiliated, I guess then you go back and reapply and see if then you're then granted the umbrella coverage. If the insurance company would say, well, we've changed, we do cover non-affiliated folks, but we don't cover Democrats. If that would undo the purpose of the amendment, or if it changes it at all, or if that's what we're actually talking about is these companies that don't cover Democrats or Republicans, but do cover non-affiliated. So I was just thinking out loud, if that is exactly what we're talking about. Thank you.
Vice Chair Allen.
Thank you. I appreciate your comment. I think that's a moot point. The point of this bill is that to cover politicians, right? Elected officials. So I think we're straying from the actual bill. And so I don't agree with the amendment. Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. And I guess this might be a question for Ms. Wingheyer. I'm curious to know what impact this would have on insurance companies and their decisions to offer certain types of insurance. So if, for example, they're prohibited from making a decision now based solely on somebody's, the likelihood somebody's going to get sued because they're an elected official, does that mean that they might stop offering that type of insurance completely? Is that like a second or third order effect that this might have, as they just say, hey, since I can't discriminate based on that factor anymore, I'm just not going to offer that type of insurance?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that's exactly where my first conversation with Representative McCabe was, that you can, as the legislature, can put this into statute and we will enforce it, but I cannot make an insurance company stay in the state of Alaska if they elect to leave, or if they elect to say, we're no longer going to write auto insurance. I can't make them do that, sir. So it could, I'm not saying it would, but we're a small state compared to other states. We have very few insurance companies to choose from, and I can't predict what they will or will not do.
Thank you, Ms. Wingheyer. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Vance. So, and that it's exactly why we tightly and narrowly focus this bill on elected officials. The party affiliation or political affiliation is what we first said. Political party seemed to tighten that up as well. I'm also not sure, and I don't. This might be my question for Representative Eastman. Would this amendment only apply to Title 21, or do you envision it applying to other things in other parts of the Alaska statutes, the definition particularly?
Representative Eastman, final wrap up.
All right. Well, I've heard lots of people say lots of things. I would say there's nothing wrong with having the ability to dialogue or have the conversations happening rather than trying to keep track of all of the different things made and respond to them all at the same time. I think Representative Carpenter's point is well made, that you know this type of you know viewpoint discrimination is something that is complicated and we probably shouldn't be getting into, and I agree we shouldn't be getting into. And yet it seems that you know we certainly see instances in society today where people are getting into it. The ability to capture beliefs simply in expressions probably works in a lot of situations, but now we have this idea that that you might be holding a belief, a bad belief, simply by the virtue of the fact you have not expressed a declination of that belief. You have not condemned. You by saying nothing and being silent, you're being told by some to hold a particular belief. I mean, we got a situation with a legislator, you know, here currently in Montana, who's being punished because you know they did not want to give an apology. So their lack of expression is now being used to punish them in some way or other. And obviously, Montana's not the only example. So it would seem to me that expression probably captures a lot of things, but this idea, which is kind of relatively new in our modern parlance of, you know, you hold a political belief because you didn't apologize, because you didn't, make a land acknowledgement at the beginning of your speech, you know, whatever it is that you didn't do, and someone's going to use that now to say, well, that you believe something you shouldn't. So I get Representative Carpenter's point, you know, it's a perilous area. But I also say, well, we are kind of here as a society, unfortunately. And to Representative McCabe's question, you know, I think we're talking specifically right now just about political parties and political views and elected status, dealing with insurance, you know, in this particular statute. I'm not, you know, thinking about other things outside of that. That's a different discussion. But, you know, also to Representative McCabe's point a moment ago, you know, there's some messy things that happen when you bring in political party membership and that sort of thing. And it would seem to me that the same messy things dealing with political views are somewhat similar in being messy dealing with political parties. So if we want to narrow the scope of the bill back to just elected officials, we might want to get rid of both. Maybe I just put that one out there.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Would the recorder please tally the roll? Call the roll.
Before we do that, I'd just like to withdraw the amendment based on hearing some of the comments of committee members. But with that suggestion that maybe we ought to withdraw the political parties as well.
Amendment number two has been withdrawn. Amendment number three, Representative Eastman.
I move amendment three.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And this goes back to part of the discussion from our previous hearing. There are a couple of different ways that we can approach this idea of discrimination based on political party or elected status, which is currently the way the bill reads. And, one way is to say, you can't do this. This is illegal. You're going to be subject to legal liability if you do this. It is, as was mentioned a moment ago, difficult to prove, perhaps. But that is one way of doing it. Amendment three is a slightly different approach. And that approach would be if, as a policy writer, you're making a decision based on these factors, then you are required to disclose that to the person that that applied for the policy. On the other side, if you are the one applying for the policy and you feel or suspect that these factors were used in the decision that went against you, then you also could ask for a justification of how the policy decision was made. So this doesn't come out and say you've engaged in illegal conduct, we're going to penalize you. That what this is saying is if either party is doing that or believes it's happened, then there's a requirement now that they provide documentation to you about whether or not that has or hasn't happened. And if it has, then as a legislator, perhaps that's something that I can take, and I now have the proof that we were kind of talking about in our last hearing, to go to personnel, to go to the legislative branch, and now say this is an issue. Here's a very tangible example. And perhaps the state, on behalf of those who are engaged in public service for their community, would be it would be appropriate for the state to bear the burden of that rather than shifting that to an insurance company.
Any discussion on amendment number three? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted clarification, and I guess I'm thinking through an example in my head. The purpose of this bill is so that somebody can't be denied insurance based on their status as an elected official. So is the purpose of this amendment that you would get documentation from the insurance company saying we denied you your coverage due to your status as an elected official? To me, it seems like if we pass this bill and the insurance company knows that they're not allowed to discriminate on that issue, then it would be very unlikely that they would give you a piece of paper in writing saying that that's the reason they discriminated against you.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think there's a reasonable path forward with this. We don't agree with this amendment. It complicates things. There are already procedures for you to follow if you get denied insurance, and it involves Director Winghire's group. I think what I'd like to do is let Mr. Witt kind of go through that, and then if Director Winghire wants to come up and amplify it, that would be a good idea on how the process would actually work.
Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Buddy Witt, for the record. So two things. One, first of all, I appreciate the amendment because this is directly related to a question that was raised when this bill was initially heard in this committee by Representative Carpenter, who wanted to know, okay, what's the mechanism for being able to prove your denial? And I should have pointed out, and I did not between last time and this, and I apologize, that the Division of Insurance on their website has a good list of what your policy rights are. And if I may read a couple of sentences here. If an insurer decides not to issue you an insurance policy when you submit your initial application, the insurer must inform you that you have a right to know why you are not being offered a policy. To receive an explanation, you must submit a written request to the insurer asking to be provided with the reasons you were refused coverage. That's Alaska statute references 21.36.440. So there's that mechanism. I will point out it does specify if you are submitting an initial application. So it's not talking about renewing an application, but there is that in there. But the other part of the amendment that we have questions on would be where it says to delete all material from page 1, line 13 through page 2, line 2. And that part of the bill is specific to kind of a carve-out to insurance companies that if they are using standard underwriting and actuarial principles in order to derive their decision, then that's okay. As long as you're doing the standard thing to determine whether someone's liability is greater than you can either offer or greater than the current cost when you're doing a renewal, we do a carve out for that. So I think that presents an issue, but there is already a mechanism to get an explanation. And so that would be the only from the discussions with the bill sponsor, that would be the two biggest things that are kind of red flags for us on this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. Any further discussion on amendment number 3? In wrap up, Representative Eason.
Thank you. Representative Gray, I think he made an initial comment earlier about, is it likely that an insurance company is going to sort of fess up to what they're doing if they're discriminating against you in this way? And I would say, it's just as unlikely as that would happen as it is that, when you ask them, why they made their decision, they're going to, admit to something that is embarrassing or gets them into trouble. There is that question in all of the different ways we talked about putting this legislation forward of, actually being able to prove that, why it was that a company made their decision. Again, this is their thought process. It's somewhat opaque unless you're a part of that decision-making process. And it can be very difficult to prove, what they were thinking at the time that they made a particular decision. So there's really no way of getting entirely around that. As to the reason why the particular language is being deleted in the amendment, it's because it's no longer relevant. If we were to pass this amendment, it's not saying that, insurance company can't, continue to make these types of decisions. It's saying that they need to, be somewhat transparent in doing so. And as the division testified earlier, there's nothing that we can do in legislation that prohibits an insurer from leaving the state of Alaska. So right now, the purpose of this bill is going to be coming forward because we have insurance providers that are making decisions that, we don't think are for the best. Under the current construction of the bill, we would in essence be telling them, sorry, you're going to make a decision that we want you to make, and you can't make the decision you've been making in the past for reasons that made sense to you. And I am afraid that in doing that, there are going to be some number of providers that say, all right, not as comfortable serving Alaska, citizens with insurance policies if you're going to require us to change our decision-making process, business model, and so forth. So this prevents that eventuality because we're not forcing them to change their decision-making process. We're simply asking for more transparency.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Would the recorder please call the roll on amendment number 3?
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Eastman.
Yes.
Representative Gray.
No.
Representative Groh.
No.
Representative Allard.
No.
Chair
No.
One yay.
By a vote of 1 yay and 6 nays, amendment number 3 has failed. House Bill 29 is now before the committee as amended. Does the bill sponsor wish to make any final remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the robust discussion over 2 days, and the amendments certainly caused a little bit of more discussion, and I appreciate you hearing the bill, and I appreciate a yes vote.
Any final comments from members before we consider taking action on the bill? Representative Eastman, briefly.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I'm looking at this bill and I'm saying this is not going to work the way that it seems to be designed and intended to work. If it's going to have an effect at all, I think the effect would be that those providers who do provide this insurance, or some of them do currently, will be providing it at a higher rate than currently. And the idea was that we get the rates to go down, but by adding this new requirements, by adding whatever compliance expenses are incurred in meeting those requirements, taking into account the risk now that you have potential litigation or lawsuits because you're thought to have violated this new requirement, none of those things decrease the premiums that legislators, governors, et cetera, will be paying. And it seems to me that this is sort of a counterintuitive and counterproductive way of solving this particular issue.
Any final comments? Vice Chair Allard, do we have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House Judiciary Committee move HB 29 version 33-LS0272S from committee as amended with the attached fiscal notes and give Legislative Legal Services permission to make all technical and conforming changes as necessary.
There has been an objection. Would the recorder please call the roll?
Representative Allard.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
No.
Representative Gray.
Pass.
Representative Brooks.
Yes.
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Yes.
68, 1 day.
Would you cancel the roll? We missed Representative Groh.
No,
we
didn't.
No, she didn't.
Oh, it.
I was pointing, Manager.
I apologize. Okay, it's the Gray Groh. I apologize. We've gotten this far. It was me. It's my fault. Would you please call it again?
Yes.
Could you just announce it again?
Representative Groh.
Yes.
Representative Allard.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
No.
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Chairman.
Yes.
6 yeas, 1 nay.
By a vote of 6 yeas and 1 nay. House Bill 29 has passed from the committee.
Thank you.
I will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. We will now bring back House Bill 129, voter registration, by the House Judiciary Committee. For the committee's awareness, we have Ms. Carol Beecher, the Director of the Division of Elections online, and Lori Wilson from the Division of Elections. And we are going to hear from my Chief of Staff, Mr. Amita, on the papers that he just set before you.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jake Almeida, Chief of Staff to Rep Vance, Committee 8 for this committee. Before you, that I just handed out. This is in reference to what HB 129 does with voter registration. And we received this from Ms. Beecher earlier today. It's the two-form process as part of the list maintenance process. And these are the actual postcards that are mailed out from the division to start the process of checking in on those who have not voted in the last two general elections, and what that process looks like to remove someone from the voter rolls. So if Ms. Beecher is online, she did not say in the email, if you could specify what the red one is for and what the blue one is for, I will let her, as part of the division, put that on the record.
This is Carol Beecher, for the record, Director of the Division of Elections, and I don't have them in color before me, but there are, should have two different mailers that you have, and one of them is the one that would say that you, it doesn't say non-forwarding, but it says, it doesn't say the forwarding service requested. If you actually, if you look in the bottom left-hand corner, it's C-17B and C-17A. A is the form that is sent out first, and that is the non-forwardable postcard. And the second one is the forwarded postcard that we send out.
Thank you, Ms. Beecher. Any questions from committee members? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Beecher, on average, how many C-17As go out per year and how many C-17Bs go out per year?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I don't know that information here, but I certainly can find out how many of those are sent.
Thank you so much.
Vice Chair Allard.
What?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. I apologize.
Further questions for Ms. Beecher?
I just want to, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to make absolutely clear, given that we now have the forms in front of us, can you just state more precisely and just make sure we nail down exactly what triggers these under current law now, what the procedure is now that we have the forms in front of us?
Through the chair, this is Carol Beecher, Representative Crowe. The process is basically is two steps. So at least once a year, the division reviews the voter registration list, and we send notices to by non-forwardable mail requesting address confirmation or correction to all voters. And the voters who have mail, whose division has, the mail has been returned to the division in the last 2 years, who have not contacted the division in the last 2 years, and who have not voted or appeared to vote in the last two general elections. If we get that back without the voter, so it's returned to us, then it's returned as undeliverable. And if they have not, within the preceding four calendar years, contacted the division, voted, or appeared to vote, we then send the second notice, which is by forwardable mail, to their last known address. And this notice is the one that tells them that their registration will be inactivated unless they respond to the notice within 45 days.
Just to make sure. So as we've said before at the previous meeting, these are just sent for people who have not had, that have met these screening criteria. That is, for example, if someone votes in every election, they don't get this.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Is there any extra cost associated with, putting the forwarding service requested on the mailing as opposed to the return service requested?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I am not aware of that, but I can check for you.
Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just want to make sure that, and this is for Jake, the bill would mean that we would no longer use C-17A, and we would just be going to a C-17B, which would be the forwardable card only. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Rep. Gray, that is correct.
Follow up.
So I guess that would be a question to Ms. Beecher. This would be a cost savings for the Division of Elections because it would be a one-step process as opposed to a two. I get it that we don't know how many of these cards we send out. If it was thousands, it would be a significant savings. If it's much less, then it would be less, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, yes, we would anticipate only sending one mailer would save the agency money. And if I might add to the question on how many notices, Representative Gray, Lori sent me the list of that, and we have a charge in our list maintenance statistics that I can send to you, but I can tell you that in 2022, it looks like we mailed 39,779 notices, but we have this, looks like it goes back to 2013, and we could provide that if you'd like.
Thank you. Just to be follow up through the chair, I just want to make sure, so was that 39,739 for the last year, or was that from since you said since 2013? Or I just want to know, is that for 1 year?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, correct. That is for that 1 year.
And was that just for C-17A, or is that a combined total of C-17A plus C-17B?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, that is the number for the first mailed notice. Okay. The second mailing that looks like it followed that up on January of 23 was 16,094.
Follow up. So through the chair, so I guess my quick math would be that meant that about 24,000 people returned the first one stating that they wanted to remain on the rolls. Would that be a correct assumption?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, yes.
Thank you so much.
Ms. Beecher, on the bottom of these cards, it says, please cancel my voter registration in the state of Alaska. Is this the only way a voter can cancel their registration?
Through the chair, no, that is not the only way. They can give us they can call us. They can do it through this form. They can send us a letter. They can email us. There are multiple ways that somebody can cancel their registration.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. And if someone were to call you up on the phone and say, I want to cancel my voter registration, is there any kind of showing of you know, that the person is the person they claim to be? Do you require them to give you their social security number or something, or do you simply, you know, take their testimony as face value?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm going to ask Lori Wilson, who's online, to answer that question, as I have not done this process.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, please continue.
Okay. Through the chair, or for the record, my name is Lori Wilson. I'm the Region 1 Supervisor for the Division of Elections. Through the chair, I couldn't hear very good on the microphone. Who was the question? Who was asking the question?
Representative Eastman, would you restate your question, please?
Thank you. And this is, again, through the chair. We just heard that someone could call in, for example, and that's one of many ways they could request their voter registration be canceled. For each of those ways that someone could request their voter registration be canceled, what demonstration is required for them to prove their identity?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, anytime an individual wants to cancel their registration and they're doing it over phone, or even if they send a request via email, we reach out to that voter and make sure that we confirm their identity through having them confirm multiple identifiers on their record before we take the steps to cancel their registration. And that's for just simply canceling. If there's notification of someone passing, of course, we would research that information through vital statistics or Social Security or other means that we have in that case.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted to make sure that I understand the difference between canceling your voter registration and becoming inactive on the voter rolls. Can you explain the difference?
Through the chair, Representative, was that Representative Gray?
Yes, Ms. Wilson.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, it's hard to hear on the phone a little bit. It's okay. I can answer that question for you. So when in our voter registration system, a voter is in what we call an active status and condition code. When they're actively participating in elections and they haven't fallen into the space where they're going to become inactive because of, you know, not voting or not participating in petitions or any kind of contact with the division, and they fall into an inactive status because of no activity or because we've canceled their registration because of a death notification, or they've moved and they've contacted us to let us know, or they've provided that information in writing, or we've been notified from another state that they've canceled, or we've had notification from Department of Corrections or from the court system that an individual has been convicted of a felony involving moral turpitude. A lot of those reasons are something that would take a voter out of an active status to what we call an inactive status, and we would change their condition code to an I for inactive, and then whatever code follows that tells us what the action was, whether they were deceased or a felon or they moved or we are notified by another state. So anybody who's in and taken from an active status to an inactive, excuse me, is still in our system as an inactive voter until a certain time frame, following our policies and procedures when their record may be removed in the instance of a person who's passed. And then those people who are in an inactive status do not appear on precinct registers, for example, at the polling place. So I hope that, does that answer your question?
Representative Gray.
Follow up. Thank you. Through the chair. So what I understand from your answer is that there's no difference between canceling and becoming inactive. That even if you are deceased, you are moved from the active to the inactive file. Is that a correct understanding of what you just said?
Right. Someone who cancels their registration is moved to an inactive status and remains in the system for a certain period of time. Yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilson, how long is that certain period of time?
Until if the voter ends up contacting us and re-registers to vote, then that would activate their record again. Or during the list maintenance process, because we have to have a way to maintain those inactive records that have been inactive for a number, for a certain time frame, during our list maintenance process, we do look at a date where we collect anybody who's been in those inactive statuses for a long period of time, such as notification of death status. We would remove them from our voter rolls at that time at the end of our list maintenance period for that year.
Representative.
So they remain in there longer than a year, but it's during our list maintenance process at the end. That's one of the ways we clean up those old records that have been in inactive status for a long time.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. So follow up through the chair. I understand that if someone's in an inactive status, the way they can become active again is to vote. And I find it surprising that someone who's deceased is moved to inactive and left there for as long as a year to see if they vote. It's a little bit surprising for me. I just want to make sure I understand it correctly, Ms. Beecher.
This is Ms. Wilson.
Sorry, Ms. Wilson.
This is Carol. Apologies. Through the chair, Carol Beecher. Representative Gray, and Lori could add to this, but for those, if we get notified that someone is deceased, the time period they would remain on the voter rolls list would be during the investigation to confirm that the information we had been provided is accurate before we would move them off. And so that's the time period for someone who that we're notified that someone is deceased.
Thank you very much. That is reassuring.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And through the chair, Ms. Beecher, how do you guys get notified that somebody is deceased? Does it come from, I guess it would be vital statistics, but who notifies you if somebody's been deceased? The Social Security office, the loved ones?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, we have a multitude of ways that we hear from or that we can hear from. Sometimes it's families. Some of the ERIC reports also give us that kind of data. They have for the number states,
They have the Social Security death register information of people who passed away in other states. We also have a regular process of looking at the obituaries, and we will follow up with those. And then, as you noted, the vital statistics that we check as well.
Can I do a follow-up?
Follow-up.
All right, so I guess what I'm hearing is that there are many ways to check, but do you guys check on a daily basis?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I believe that we weekly remove deceased voters based on the obituaries, and again, checking to make sure that the information we have is accurate. And we do a monthly check of the Division of Vital Statistics. The ERIC reports are, I believe that they are quarterly. So it varies a little bit.
Can you do a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. I don't know if I have a question out of this or have a comment, but monthly is alarming to me. Elections happen all the time. And I hear the word believe instead of yes or no. And so I'm concerned on how we can tighten that up and what we need to do as policymakers to have that happen. And if you could possibly give me a list of all the people that have been removed from the voter roll of deceased from January 1st of 2023 until present day. Let's just wrap it up to be 5 May. Could I get that from you, your office?
To the chair, Representative Allard, yes, we would be happy to provide that.
Thank you. And if I could get it broken down, like not just, oh, these are the people we've had removed in the 4 months. I'd like to know when you had them removed and when you were notified to when they were removed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Allard, this bill seeks to provide more tools and tighten up that process. And one of the, and we do list the United States Social Security Administration Death Index as one of those options in statute. While the division may be utilizing many of these practices, there are more that we just want to provide clarity in statute. Representative Eason.
Thank you for the chair. Just to follow up on Representative Gray's question earlier. So I understand there's an investigation when someone has died or they might have died or the division suspects they've died or someone's told them they've died. And then at the end of that investigation, their voter registration is canceled. Did I hear you to say earlier that as soon as the division is notified that someone might possibly have died, that's when they're somewhat immediately moved to that inactive status? Or if not immediately, how long does it take if somebody contacts the division or through some other means, the division, you know, understands that they should, you know, engage in an investigation or maybe they're deciding on whether or not to engage in an investigation. At what point does that inactive status kick in?
Through the chair, Representative Easton, I'm going to ask Lori to respond to that.
Okay, through the chair, Representative Eastman, regarding, I'd like to also make a clarification on death notifications. We process those daily from a variety of resources. We get notified by clerks. We research obituaries. One of our regional offices receives a monthly report from Vital Statistics, but we are receiving information and processing information daily. We get calls or forms filled out by family members that contact us. So those are processed daily. And when we receive those notices or as we're researching obituaries, if we research an obituary, for an example, and we see that that voter has is deceased, we look them up in our system. If we don't already have that notified on their record, because we also have access to Social Security and DMV, which also list when an individual is deceased. So if we don't already have that information in our system, then we use that obituary for confirming their information, and then we immediately change their condition code from an active voter to an inactive deceased voter, which means they would never appear on a voter roll and that sort of thing once we put them in that status. So it's something that we do on a daily basis, just like we do voter registration on a daily basis.
Follow up?
Follow up.
And does the division also, as you're, you know, going through these obituaries and whatnot, do you also take note of when people enter custody? For example, you know, if someone is in custody and not able to vote, do you wait for the Division of Corrections or Department of Corrections to notify you? Or, you know, when you see that, you know, headline in the newspaper, is that what, you know, triggers that process? Or likewise, I know we saw recently the individual was, you know, convicted of voting illegally in Alaska and Florida. I think the prosecution of that happened in Florida. Is that the type of thing that the division would take note of and would move someone, you know, off the active voter roll?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we receive reports from the courts that tell us when an individual has been convicted of a crime that involves moral turpitude, because oftentimes somebody might be arrested for something, for a certain crime that might be under the felony of moral turpitude, but then during their hearings and through their due process, they may, the charge may be either reduced to a misdemeanor or some other action may be taken place that wouldn't categorize them anymore in a felony of moral turpitude category. We also get notifications from Department of Corrections regularly, but we do use the courts because we know that people could be sentenced and awaiting trial in corrections and not necessarily be convicted at that time.
And so what about the situations where it's not the Alaska courts that the individual is being prosecuted in? For example, the individual in Florida being prosecuted in the Florida courts, even though they were obviously registered to vote in Alaska. They did vote in Alaska. They also voted in Florida, which triggered the prosecution. If the convictions aren't coming through Alaska court, how would the division become aware and move that person off the active voter roll?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'd be happy to follow up with one of our regional offices that oversees this, the majority of the felony correspondence and see if they what their process is for handling those and if they get a separate report from out of state. I know once in a while we get federal reports that we go through, but I'm not sure if she receives out of state reports regularly as well, so we can follow up with you on that.
Thank you. That would be appreciated.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Do we have separate voter rolls for those only in federal elections? You talked about sometimes getting information from the feds. How do we have the distinction for those who would not be eligible to vote in our state elections?
Through the chair, I'm happy to answer that. Representative Vance, is that who asked that question?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So an individual who has indicated to the Division of Elections that they are a permanent overseas voter, we mark them in our system as what we call an IOS voter. That means they're inactive, but they're overseas, which means to us that they can participate in federal races only on the ballot. Was that your question?
Partially, Ms. Wilson. Are they a part of the overall inactive list, or is it a completely separate list?
Oh, thank you for clarifying that. So through the chair, Representative Vance, in our database, I can look up inactive voters the same time, you know, as well as active voters. So there's not a separate list. They're in the same database, but are the voters, because of their status and condition code, is what is how we can filter them through reports and things like that. And so when an individual who is flagged as an IOS voter, meaning that they're from overseas and they can only participate in federal races, the absentee and petition office knows that that code tells them when they go to mail the ballots that those particular voters that have that status and condition code will only receive the federal ballot forms and envelope and the federal only ballot itself. And then when those ballots come back, those ballots will only have the federal races counted.
Thank you for that clarification. I'd like to go back to the notice and the conversation about the identifiers. And a couple of years ago, there was a data breach in the Division of Elections that affected 113,000 Alaskans with their personal information, which included these identifiers. If someone were to receive one of these confirmation notices in the mail, we know that mail is easily accessible. How has the division filtered through the potential that those Alaskans' information could be used by a bad actor? What has the division done to make sure that someone else is not voting with their identifier information?
Through the chair, this is Carol Beecher, director. Chair Vance, I can tell you how we have hardened our system and provide you with an update on that. But as far as, are you referring to if someone had access to the voter registration number to order a ballot? Am I understanding that that's your question?
Well, Ms. Beecher, with 113,000 Alaskans' personal information out there that was hacked, could someone use that to either request a ballot from the division electronically or directly, or simply get find a registration confirmation notice, change the address to someone else using the personal identifiers as if they were impersonating one of the Alaskans whose information was hacked? Is that a possibility? And what has the division done to check to see if that is in fact happening?
Or cancel the registration?
Through the chair, Representative Chair Vance. I will need to, this happened before my time, and I have the documentation that I provided, but I would need to circle back to my security staff and provide you with information on that.
I understand this feature, and thank you for that follow-up. Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess to the Division of Elections, and I was going down the same road you were. Is there a check and balance that you see of number of ballots from a particular, if you start getting 20 ballots from the same address, is there a flag anywhere?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I would have to say that my understanding, but Lori, maybe you can answer that. I have not undergone an election, but that would definitely be something that would be a red flag.
Sure. This is Lori through the chair. Representative, was that Representative Groh?
Johnson, but that's okay. I'm beyond
Johnson, I apologize. So if we saw a bunch of applications coming from the same address, I think that was your question, the division staff, that definitely is something that the division would be flagged for looking for. Anything that was out of the ordinary, we would certainly take a look at and investigate further.
Follow up.
Is there signature verification on the final cancellation notice or any of the other notices that you've been sending out to verify that the signature matches in any way?
Is that Representative Johnson again?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Johnson. Currently in statute, there's no signature verification process per se, but we do capture signatures on the voter's record. So if we've had a document that has the voter's signature, we do have those images that we can use to look at that information on the voter's record, as well as use their identifiers to complete. And also the mailer that we send out, usually has an obscured voter card or voter number on it. So we also know the voter number, the name, and can compare all that to the voter's identifier and signature if needed.
Would you tell me what an obscured identification is?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, it's just it, we take their voter number and we I don't know the best way to say it. We just make it so it's not clearly visible as a voter number.
So it's like a watermark actually on each individual. So each of these cancellations or final notice of cancellations has a watermark on it that verifies the same information or voter number that is identified on that the voter potential voter has puts down.
On the mailer that we send out, it's addressed to the voter, and then we have a barcode that identifies that voter, and when needed, we can add an obscured voter number as well to that that is unique to the division.
Follow up.
And I'm specifically looking at your final cancellation notice and your voter registration confirmation notice. I don't see a barcode or anything on the information that we have. So when these go out, there's a barcode to make sure it's going to the voter whose number is written down?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes. The forms that you have are just blank, you know, blank templates of the form that we send to the vendor, and then the vendor takes our list of voters who have fallen into the category to receive the particular form that you're looking at, and the addressing is like a mail merge, so our information is pulled from our list and put onto the mailer for each voter. So each card has the voter's unique information tied to it.
Follow up.
So each of those barcodes has voter number, birth date, Social Security last four,
and no
license on every one of them?
No, sorry, through the chair. No, it doesn't pertain. It doesn't. The barcode is just an identifier, like their voter number identifier for when we're receiving those back. We can scan it to pull up their record. It does not hold any of the voter's personal information like date of birth, driver's license, or anything like that. No.
No, I'm sure. I hate to go down a rabbit hole, but if I get a final cancellation notice and I put down my birth date and I want to change my address and I sign it, what's keeping me from being the hacker that got the notification or the list that was hacked into?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the mailer is addressed to the individual themselves, so it's going to their address that we have on file for them. So it's not going to a random person's house, but it's going directly to the person who's addressed to. But whether we can prevent somebody from, you know, taking someone else's mail, we don't have that ability once the mailer's in the mail, if that's your question.
Yes, and I appreciate that. But more specifically, if I call in or one of the other ways, text the other ways, and I have a bad player and I have your birth date, and I send a voter registration change of address, and so all of a sudden this one address or multiple addresses starts getting ballot applications, how do you stop that? I guess to cut down to the chase, changing addresses, especially on the inactive roll, who may or may not be around, haven't voted in 2 years, wouldn't have a clue they're not getting their ballot. So I'm an inactive roll voter. Someone's got access to my information. They call in and change the address, and now you have someone other than the original voter voting. Tell me how you prevent that.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I can take a stab at that, and then if the director wants to follow up, then she can do that. So if an individual calls us to change their, they can't change a residence over the phone, they can change a mailing address over the phone, but we would request multiple identifiers for that individual before we did that. Could we, you know, how can we prevent, other than verifying all the identifiers that we have on file for an individual and looking at their signature, we wouldn't necessarily know that someone else is calling in, I guess is the best way to say it. I don't know that how anybody would be able to tell that if somebody has everybody's identifier.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are there other voter identifiers besides the one listed on the final cancellation notice, voter birth date, Social Security, or last four driver's license number? Is there something additional to that? Because if I packed into the system, I've got those.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, those are the identifiers that we have available for voters to provide to us in our voter registration system. So we have voter number, we have Social Security number, last four digits, we have their date of birth, and their Alaska driver's license number or state ID number if it's been provided in the past.
I don't think I have any more questions. I'm perplexed a little bit.
Representative Johnson, thank you,
Madam Chair.
Before we go to a question from Representative Gray, I have one more question that's going to put the cherry on top for you.
Oh, good.
Ms. Wilson, since you already said that there's currently no voter signature verification process, what types of signatures are currently acceptable by statute?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, are you talking about like electronic signature or that sort of thing?
When someone sends in any of the cancellation notice or a ballot and a signature is required, what is deemed acceptable?
We do, like I said, on through the chair, Representative Vance, we do have images of the voter signature on our form. I mean, excuse me, on each voter's record. If they've responded with a form or submitted a form in the past, like a registration form, absentee form, we gather their signature and collect that image. So we do have the voter signature available on their record that we can pull up when we have their record in front of us. And we can compare signatures that way.
Through the chair, Chair Vance, this is Carol Beecher. To add to what she's saying, in statute 1507060 number 9, it requires that we have the applicant's signature, or it could be a mark. So, it could be an X. So we don't necessarily have every signature available in our system.
Thank you, Ms. Beecher, that you hit the nail on the head that of the concerns that bad actors could use a mark instead of a signature with this information. And I think that's kind of what the bill is trying to get at, is to help the division clean the voter rolls and tighten up our security. One last question before we close, Representative Gray.
Sure. Thank you. Through the chair. So it seems that there was concern that 118,000 voters' information was hacked into and stolen. And so I'm curious in that. It seems to me if the bad actor was using that information to register to vote or to change voter registrations, that people would go to vote when someone had already voted for them. So I'm curious about how many people attempted to vote twice. You know, in this case, it would be unknowingly. You would just go to vote and they'd be like, you've already voted. How many cases of those have we had since that hack?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, we have not had any indicators that the information has been used to vote for somebody for nefarious purposes. We do not have any data that shows that, and have instituted multiple hardening of our system, hardening of access since that incident occurred, including the patching and penetration tests. We undergo
We follow the NIST. We have a program in place now for our security under the NIST cybersecurity framework model. And we get weekly and daily reports about data flows, firewall events, Active Directory security reviews, et cetera. So there's a multitude of things that have been put into place since that happened to make sure that outside actors are not able to have access to the system.
Thank you.
Ms. Beecher, I know that you were not there during this hack, and so I appreciate all the insight that you can give us from looking into this issue. But do you know if there has been a comparison of how many of the 113,000 Alaskans impacted by this were on the inactive voter list?
Through the chair, Chairman Vance, I don't have that information, but are you asking for a list of people who are now inactive who were part of that 113?
Or who were currently inactive at the time of the breach?
I will see if I can find that information for you.
Thank you. And we have one last question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this will probably fall in the same research. Do you have any way of tracking someone who's been on the inactive list that all of a sudden pops up and starts voting again? Is there any way you can track that?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I don't know the answer to that, but I can check with our security and my staff and find out that answer for you.
So, and just to clarify, my understanding was that if you're on the inactive roll, one of the ways to activate it is to vote. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, that's correct.
That would be the people I'm interested in looking at that were inactive and all of a sudden came back and were voting. Just as a number, just to see. Because I see that inactive roll as maybe something we can address by statute and maybe clean that up a little bit. I see that as dangerous. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I know that we have further questions. We will hear this bill again on Friday. Thank you, Ms. Beecher and Ms. Wilson, for being available and for gathering up the questions that we do have. And I would just like to say that that the Division of Elections has been following statute, but in my research in the past few years, our statutes are not as thorough as Alaskans would assume them to be on elections in the authority granted to the Division of Elections. And that is what this bill seeks to address, is to provide more clarity and process in statute. So that concludes our business for today. I want to remind members that the amendment deadline for this bill is tomorrow by 5 p.m. Additionally, the amendment deadline for House Bill 11, Crime, Assault in the Presence of a Child, is today by 5 p.m. That concludes our business for today. House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Friday, May 5th at 1 p.m. to continue its work on House Bill 129 and also bring back House Bill 11, Crime, Assault in the Presence of a Child, in its second hearing by Representative Josephson. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It is 3:01 p.m.